The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Kian Prendeville is an activist in Limerick, a member of the Socialist Party, and a member of the Limerick Soviet Centenary Committee. He is currently producing a 5-part documentary podcast, Bottom Dog, The Story of the Limerick Soviet, and he is the guest on this week's podcast. It's Wednesday, June 5th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books, and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is available in full for everyone. Our Patreon supporters get access to 2 podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. But if you're listening on our free feed, you'll always be able to get access to one or the other podcast each week. The Patreon-only video series, which I'm now deciding will be called Disco Communism, will be coming in the next week, and the audio from that first episode will be made available on this feed as well. The music you're listening to right now is Michael Balfe's The Bohemian Girl, but in just a moment you'll be listening to a conversation about the Limerick Soviet. Kian Prendeville is a former Solidarity counselor and a general election candidate for Limerick City. He's been a fighter against austerity and inequality in Limerick for over 10 years, and he's also the podcaster behind Bottom Dog, The Story of the Limerick Soviet. Kian, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks for having me. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
All right. Tell me about being a Solidarity counselor and about the Solidarity Party.
Yeah, so Solidarity is a left-wing political party in Ireland initiated by the Socialist Party together with, which is part of the CWI, the Committee for Workers International, a Trotskyist organization, but together with other ordinary activists that came out of the anti-household tax, which was a movement against an austerity tax that was being imposed. And together with those activists, this new left alternative was launched and succeeded in winning. So in Ireland, there's 3 TDs and members of parliament from the Socialist Party CWI tradition. There's 3 members of parliament from the SWP, a British SWP IST tradition. There's quite a large sort of far left Trotskyist presence in the Irish Dáil anyway. And in Limerick, where I'm based, we had a major movement against water charges, and we came very close to winning a parliamentary seat in Limerick as well. But we did win a number of council seats out of that as well. It's quite a strange experience. I've given it up now, but it was quite a strange experience being a revolutionary and a socialist and being in meetings, because I was the party leader of our group, so I got to be in these private meetings that was just the private, like, there's no media, it's only the heads of the civil service and the key people from each party, but they're chatting about stuff as if we're all best friends, you know, and making plans to go for drinks afterwards, and you're sort of there like sticking out like a sore thumb, like you showed up at the funeral in a clown outfit, kind of a strange experience.
Yeah, or you showed up at the cocktail party with a red flag.
Yeah, exactly. You've stormed heaven, but the angels aren't too happy.
Right. Well, so, but what you just said was really interesting to me, that how many different socialist parties are there in Ireland?
There's 2 main large ones. So there's the Socialist Party and there's Socialist Workers Network, which is formerly Socialist Party, and both are involved in left-wing electoral groups called Solidarity, in our case, and People for Profit in their case, and they come together in the Dáil on the ballot line. It's the one, there's the one ballot line. It's the one official party, Solidarity People for Profit. And in the Dáil, they sit together. But organisationally, they, you know, they're two separate sort of structures. There's concrete programmatic differences that would have come up in terms of, so a major issue in Ireland would be corporation tax, which Ireland has a super low level of corporation tax. And so in the last election, Solidarity would have stood on a demanding to double the corporation tax. People for Profit would have stood more so on a basis of enforcing the current level of corporation tax, because even though it's 12.5%, the Facebooks and the Googles in Ireland get away with paying like 1 or 2%, you know. So there'd be some programmatic differences on the national question in terms of the North. There'd be the differences as well. And then there's also, as you say, the sort of like historical things. But there is a like when push comes to shove, there is cooperation and collaboration in terms of sharing a ballot line and making sure that, you know, that the left has the strongest face in the parliament and in the media as possible, and in different campaigns as well.
How did you come to create the Bottom Dáil podcast on the history of the Limerick Soviet?
Yeah, so I'm involved in a group called Limerick Soviet 100, which is commemorating the centenary of the Limerick Soviet, because it took place in April 1919. This is 100 years since then. And we've been organised, and it's there's different left activists from different traditions involved in it, trade union activists, people like that, involved in organising the festival. And that involves some political events, film showings, a big, but also artistic events. There's a major new play, there's music nights, stuff like that, a whole like festival of arts and activism. But as part of that, I thought that producing a podcast documentary to try to tell this fascinating story. I find it fascinating, not only because it's my own city, but also because it sort of sticks out from the traditional history of the Irish Revolution, of this revolutionary period. It sticks out from that, from the way that story is normally told. It shines a light on the class struggles that were taking place and the socialist movement that was taking place at that stage as well. So I decided that if I could produce a podcast, that might help popularize this story a bit more and bring it to a new audience, and also dip my toe in the podcasting waters and get more of a sense of how that all works.
Well, I welcome you to the podcasting community with open arms, comrade.
One of us.
Yeah.
One of us.
But could you just tell the listeners the story of the Limerick Uprising in a few minutes, just because I had to be acquainted with it, so I imagine some of my audience might not be aware of it. So,
I would say you're right. Even most people in Limerick wouldn't really be aware of it. What it was fundamentally, it was a general strike rather than a Soviet. In a sense, the workers in Limerick went out on general strike. Limerick is a small city on the west coast of Ireland. And, in 1919, the British military imposed martial law after a very large funeral for a Republican activist. They imposed martial law that they set up checkpoints around the city, which would mean that a lot of workers who would have lived on one side of a checkpoint and worked on the other side, they would have had to get permits from the British military in order to go to work. And what happened is, in one of those workforces, a place called Cleves, which produced condensed milk and toffee and things like that, those workers who were particularly affected, they took a decision to go out on strike. They were organised by a Marxist, Sean Dowling, and he then represented them at the Trades Council, which brought together all the Limerick trade unions. And at a meeting of the Trades Council, the whole Trades Council agreed to come out on strike, that they would join that strike. And so for 2 weeks, there was this general strike. But like any like prolonged general strike, it poses the question of power. You're out on strike, but what are you going to do for food? So they had to reopen the bakeries. They were running out of grain. So what were they going to do? They went and they they unloaded grain from a boat that was in the docks. They requisitioned it, commandeered it. So they started taking over the running of the city, essentially, for 2 weeks.
Who had died, and how had this funeral been so large or threatening that martial law was declared?
There's a guy, the person who died was called Bobby Byrne or Robert Byrne. He was an Irish volunteer, a member of the IRB or the IRA. And he was also, he had been a trade unionist and a telegraph worker. He died in a failed rescue attempt. I suppose part of the reason why the British got so worked up about it was that in that rescue attempt, a British soldier also died.
Now, he was being rescued?
Yeah, so he was in prison. He was arrested. He was in prison for possession of a gun. He went on hunger strike. He got moved to a hospital because his condition was deteriorating. And then I think it's April 6th, on a Sunday, 1919, the IRA tried to break him out of the hospital. But in the commotion, shots were fired, and a British soldier ended up dying, as well as Robert Byrne.
I'm going to go back one more step. Why did he have a gun? What was going on when he was arrested?
He was in the IRA. That's what it is.
Yeah.
The background to that was in January of 1919, at the end of 1918, there was parliamentary elections for the British Parliament, and they would have included Ireland at that stage. So there was a whole load of Irish MPs elected, and they would have been from Sinn Féin, from the bourgeois Nationalist Party, they wanted independence, but wanted to keep capitalism. But they declared themselves, they said they weren't going to go over to Westminster, they weren't going to sit in the British Parliament, and instead they set up an Irish Parliament in January 1919. And they declared themselves the legitimate government of Ireland. Obviously, if you're going to do that, you're probably going to expect that there'll be shots fired. So began to get prepared for that. And also, the same day as their first sitting, there was shots fired, and there was an ambush that took place as well. So it was this period was actually the start of what became known as the War of Independence, which was basically the war between the Irish Parliament, well, led by the Irish Parliament, over which government was the legitimate government in Ireland.
And so he was caught up in that conflict. He had a gun, and he was arrested and imprisoned. He was a union organizer or a workers organizer at that point. Right.
There's some debate about how much he was involved in the trade unions. He was definitely a member of the union. He was a worker in the Telegraph, and that was a unionized workplace. I've seen some people claim that he wasn't actually, that his main area of political activity was the Republican movement rather than the trade union movement. But I can't vouch for that. But he definitely had that mantle. And so when he died, the Trades Council also passed a motion of sympathy because he had been a member of the Trades Council. You know, he had that credibility on the basis of that. Whether it was really earned or not, I don't know.
Right. So then he gets killed. He's struggling for Irish independence. He gets imprisoned and then killed in a rescue attempt. And there's this massive outpouring of horror and anger and sympathy and mourning, and they storm, they take the streets, people take the streets in the thousands and thousands, and the British panic and institute martial law. Is that basically what happened?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But then there's an unexpected result of stirring up class resentment. I mean, it wasn't really, in the minds of the British, wasn't about class; it was about Irish independence.
Yeah, in their minds, it was trying to put people back in their place. But I think that for a lot of people that were involved at this stage, they saw the two issues as connected, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want Britain to rule you, but you also didn't want your boss to rule you. You didn't want to live in really terrible housing and have low wages and whatever. So people like Sean Dowling, who was a Marxist organizer in what was quite a radical trade union called the ITGWU, which had been set up by two syndicalists, well, one syndicalist and one Marxist. But Sean Dowling would have seen that what he was fighting for was like a socialist republic or a workers' republic, which would mean that, you know, you'd overthrow not just imperialism, but overthrow capitalism. And he was the key organizer for the ITGWU in Limerick, which grew very rapidly from zero to about 3,000 members between 1917 and 1919, which 3,000 out of there was probably 15,000 workers, people working in Limerick at that point in time. So it was quite significant.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's interesting that the rank and file of the working class, you know, were kind of unpredictable. And what started out maybe as a conflict between bourgeois factions, I mean, regardless of the morality of one side over the other, I mean, obviously I'm on the side of the IRB there, but underneath that picture, there's this class war going on, and the martial law sort of sets it off.
But the reality is that the IRB or Sinn Féin were actually not in favor of the strike.
Right.
Weren't on the side of the workers either. They tried to pour cold water on it, and because they didn't want either the trade union movement stealing their thunder and leading the struggle against imperialism, but they also feared socialism or Bolshevism, as it would have been, you know, called at the time.
Right.
And actually, going on a few years to when they struck a deal with Britain and got the Free State was established, or Free State was established, both factions in the IRA ended up crushing similar strikes and Soviets and things like that right across the country. So I think that the one thing that united the British Army and the heads of the nationalist movement was an opposition to socialism and an opposition to revolutionary action.
Now, when you say they crushed it, you mean militarily?
Not the Limerick Soviet, but in 3 years later, you would have had there was a series of what was called the Munster Soviets. So Limerick is a city, but in the province of Munster. Those Soviets would have literally been crushed militarily by the IRA as well, by both sides of the IRA.
Okay, so let's zoom in here on the moment before the Limerick Soviet got taken apart by both sides of this conflict over independence. And just to ask yourself, like, how did the strike come about? I understand, I listened to a little of your podcast, that women workers were sort of in the vanguard of the strike, or that they led this whole movement.
The ITGWU in Limerick would have organized women workers who had, you know, the traditional unions in Limerick at that stage, up till then, were craft unions, you know, carpenters and bakers and tradespeople, sort of almost semi-guilds. They wouldn't have really organized female workers, but the ITGWU did. Big factory, one of the big factories that they organized was Cleves, as I mentioned earlier on, and that was predominantly women workers, or majority of them were women workers. They were quite a radical branch of the union. They had been involved in numerous strike actions before the Limerick Soviet, but they also were one of the most affected by martial law, because when the British set up martial law, they set up these checkpoints, but they set up one checkpoint on a bridge that was just beside that factory. So it meant that all those workers had to pass through the checkpoint, so they were particularly hardly affected by it. We don't know fully the details of exactly what happened, but on the Friday, there was a meeting of the trades councils of all the trade unions, where Sean Dowling, the Marxist in the ITGWU, argued that the trades councils should take over City Hall, that they should start having their meetings in City Hall. That was sort of brushed under the carpet bureaucratically, and said, look, we'll come back to that at a different day. That was the Friday. On the Saturday, Dowling then organised a meeting of those workers in Cleves, and they voted to come out on strike. And then on the Sunday, There was another meeting of all the trade unions where, again, they were debating this time the question of a solidarity strike, of all coming out and strike. And this time there was thousands of workers outside lobbying the trade unions, essentially to support that call for a strike. And so on Sunday, the 13th of April, they voted, after a 12-hour meeting, they voted to declare a citywide general strike. And from 5 a.m. the next day, everything was closed.
So what were the consequences for the workers when there were these checkpoints set up? Were people upset because they were arriving at work late because of the bureaucracy of providing passes or getting permission to travel to work? Or is it symbolic? It was more symbolic?
Yeah, I think it was more symbolic. That to get a pass, you had to go down to the barracks and you had to be interrogated by the British military. They had to take down your details and then they'd issue you with a pass to say that you were allowed to go. And at a certain stage, there was a proposal raised by the bosses of the city. And actually by Sinn Féin. They said, well, hold on, how about if instead of the military issuing the passes, how about if the bosses issue the passes? That you don't have to go to the barracks to get your pass. You can just go into your boss's office and, you know, he'll issue you one. And the workers also said, no, we don't want to be having to bend the knee to anyone in order to just travel around our city. So I think it wasn't the traffic jam that it caused, if you know what I mean. It was more the symbolism of having to bow down before somebody just in order to go about your daily life, you know.
Well, you mentioned that they wanted to take the city council. I mean, it seems like once the general strike started, the aim of it shifted from getting rid of the passes to taking political power in Limerick. Is that right?
It's tough to know. The problem is there's no minutes from those meetings, which is really annoying if you're trying to study the history. So we don't fully know. And even Sean Dowling, he was a prolific organizer, and he went on to organize a whole load of other strikes and stuff, but he wasn't a prolific writer. He never wrote down his reflections on the time. So we don't really know whether it was pragmatism, sort of they ran out of food, so they reopened the bakeries. They ran out of grain, so they seized the grain. You know, whether it was then they ran out of money, so they started printing their own money. Traditionally, it's been told in that way, that it's been sort of a pragmatic one step, next step, the step after that. I'm not so convinced. I think that there was probably more of a conscious, especially from Dowling, who, like, he was a Marxist. He went on, at that stage, he was a member of the Socialist Party of Ireland. He went on to form the Revolutionary Socialist Party. I find it hard to think that he wasn't consciously, you know, this was in the backdrop of the Russian Revolution, obviously, only a few months previously, the events in Germany, the German Revolution. I imagine that in his head, at least, there was a certain conscious element of it, and the debates within the Trades Council.
How long after was it, around the same time that the attempt of a German revolution had been put down, that this happened? I mean, the success of Lenin and the Bolsheviks must have been a big influence on people in Limerick, but, or at least the Marxists, you know, the organizers. But were they thinking about Germany as well? And were they getting any support from the new Soviet Union?
I definitely, and not just for the Marxists, the events in Russia and Germany, we definitely know Russia, but I also suspect Germany would have been an inspiration. Because, like, on May Day 1918, so a year previously, Limerick had its first May Day march, and about 15,000 people marched, and they passed a resolution which was sending revolutionary greetings to their comrades in Russia in their struggle for political and social emancipation, to paraphrase it. So it was, and that was 15,000 people. That wasn't just, you know, the Marxists. Those events had definitely inspired people in Limerick, and I'd imagine the events in Germany. So in about 6 months prior to the Limerick Soviet, the German Kaiser would have been toppled by the first wave of the German Revolution. So you had a Tsar who had been ruled Russia for centuries was gone. A Kaiser who had ruled Russia, who ruled Germany, was gone. You know, empires were being defeated. They were crumbling. And I've no doubt that that influenced and inspired people in Limerick. And we know that there's which you know, there's a historical record that proves that. In terms of solidarity, the other way, somebody has, I can't remember the name now, but somebody has gone through and has researched some of the Russian newspapers at the time and has found a story in one of the Soviet state papers, newspapers about the Limerick Soviet and wishing it well and reporting to the people in Russia what was going on. In terms of concrete aid or anything like that, I don't think that came up. Well, there's no record to show that there was any direct communication, but there was only reporting of it. It never really went on that long either. If you're only got, you know, I'd say it took longer than 2 weeks for a ship to get from Russia for any aid to arrive. So it never really, and they were more.
How long did the whole thing last?
Just 2 weeks.
Yeah.
The strike itself lasted 2 weeks. Obviously the build up and the wind down went on a bit longer. But the hope of it was that it would spread. So from day one, when they came out on strike in Limerick, the rail workers submitted notice to their boss that they were going to go out and strike in 2 days' time. They had to give 2 days' notice to do that. And the rails at that stage, there would have been, it was the internet of its day, you know, everything could go on the rail line. So if they had come out, that would have shut the whole country down. Even the British military relied on the trains to transport their troops around the place, you know. So there was... And there was the National Trade Union and newspapers were talking about a general strike. The leaders were making speeches saying that the full strength of the labour movement would be brought out in support of Limerick, heavily implying that there was about to be a general strike called. So that was the hope, was that this could have spread nationally.
What I remember hearing was that there was quite a lot of material support from other workers to the workers in Limerick.
Yeah, there would have been a food was delivered. They smuggled food into the city, which was kind of, they did it in multiple ways. But the best one was that there was a lot of fake funerals that started outside of the checkpoints and ended inside the checkpoints. But the British troops never cracked open the caskets. But if they did, they wouldn't have found any bodies. The caskets were full of food, you know. So that was one way they got it. But there was also money being sent by some of the trade unions. There was collections done around the country as well. So there was that grassroots solidarity coming. But unfortunately, the tops of the trade union movement were found wanting.
It was a popular strike. I mean, the workers nationally were behind it, at least sentimentally, and enough to contribute to it. Where they could.
Yeah, and the fact that the rail workers were indicating that they'd come out. In general, there seemed to be that if they were called, they would have come out in support. And to be honest with you, I think if it had escalated, it probably wouldn't have become a socialist revolution. If it had escalated, if there was a 24-hour general strike even, I would say the British would have, the next day, withdrawn martial law. It would have won, you know, very quickly if there had been some sort of national action that came from it.
They'd had a national action and they'd gotten their demand of withdrawing martial law met. Would they have stopped? Or would workers continue to try to seize power at that point?
I think it definitely would have been a confidence boost. It definitely would have established that notion that we can, you know, run this ourselves. And who knows where it could have led. I don't know. There's a danger. There's in all these counterfactual thinking, it's a bit different because you're just where it's more sci-fi than it is history.
I'm just thinking about, I wrote a novel about, you know, the Paris strikes in May of 1968. And in that case, it's clear because it's close enough to us that we know that the students and workers who organized the strikes and riots in Paris at the beginning had the aim of taking power one way or the other. How exactly they wanted to do it, it's unclear. And that also did seize the nation. I mean, there were millions of workers on strike in May of 68, not just in Paris, but nationally.
Definitely.
But
during this whole period in Irish history, there was that possibility posed, you know. The year before, there had been a general strike against conscription. In the years after, there was other general strikes. There was a whole series of workplace Soviets. Socialists were elected. Stuff like, you know, there was a real ferment, and there was a lot of worry that there's government Irish the Irish government papers where they warn about the danger of Bolshevism and all that. You know, it was a real possibility posed. But the tragedy of Limerick and the tragedy of the time is that it wasn't the Sean Dowlings, it wasn't the Marxists that won the leadership of the workers' movement, won the leadership of the working class. It was the conservative conciliators, people like William O'Brien and Tom Johnson, who feature a bit in the podcast. They were the ones that in the leadership of it. And instead of leading the workers' movement in a socialist direction, they fell in line behind Sinn Féin, and they said Labour must wait. That first we'll just stay quiet and play supporting second fiddle to Sinn Féin, and then we'll win a seat at the table in a new capitalist Ireland. We'll have a seat at the table with the government, and we'll slowly improve things inch by inch. But effectively, that meant that in Limerick, they were on the wrong side, and at that period in time, that they blocked the revolutionary potential that was there.
Well, why were they able to succeed? I mean, you mentioned earlier that the rail workers were, you know, willing to go on strike, but I guess their union leaders put an end to that. Why did the rail workers not go on a wildcat strike? Why were they able to be constrained by their leadership? And I mean, the Limerick workers had not been, right? It was not. Was it the union that called for the strike? Or was it the workers that called for the strike in Limerick?
Well, it was a unanimous vote of the Trades Council to come out on strike, but they had been lobbied to do that. You know, you had in position Sean Dowling, a Marxist who was well rooted, was the organizer of the ITGWU, had built up that a base of support, and was then able to mobilise those workers. He got the Cleves workers to come out on strike. He then was able to go to the Trades Council and say, join this, come out with us. There was people outside lobbying. You know, they were able to pile the pressure on. But there was some degree of organisation there. There was revolutionaries in a position to really affect things when the opportunity was there, you know. And I think that's the problem, is that there wasn't revolutionaries in a strong enough position, or maybe organised enough at this stage, to really challenge and to go over the heads of the conservative trade union leaders and to say, well, we should come out on strike anyway, or to organise that in their, you know, themselves. That the revolutions that did exist were sort of maybe slightly networked a bit, but they weren't organised into a revolutionary centre or a party in a real sense. So there wasn't that sort of coordination, unfortunately.
Well, I have a final question on my list here, and it's one that I am hesitant to ask because it makes me sound like a bourgeois swine to ask it. But here it goes. Given the failure of the Soviet experiment and the Soviet Union, notice I'm reading it as if I hadn't written it, should we think of the failure of the Limerick struggle, the failure to nationalize the strike and take power, as a moment where the Irish people dodged a bullet?
Well, Doug, that question exposes you as a bourgeois swine. No, I think I can understand. That is a question that like in the comments section is often said on wherever I've written about the Limerick Soviet, or people say, you know, thank God we avoided that. And I can understand, I'm not saying, you know, like what Stalin ended up doing in Russia, the all that is not the vision that people in Limerick were fighting for, or the vision that I'd be fighting for. But I think coming from a Trotskyist perspective myself, and I think that the possibilities that existed at that stage was that if Limerick had succeeded, if Ireland had gone socialist, or if the German Revolution had succeeded and established a socialist republic, or Hungary or Italy or any of these, I think that could have changed the whole course of history. That could have avoided the isolation of Russia, which fed Stalinism, which allowed Stalin to rise to the top, brutally suppressing all opposition, including from the genuine socialists. But if there had been, if the revolution hadn't remained isolated, if it had spread outside Russia to Ireland or Germany or whatever, I think that you could have also not only avoided the horrors of World War II, of fascism and all that, but you could have avoided horrors of Stalinism and instead established a genuine socialist workers' democracy, not with a bureaucracy at the top brutally suppressing workers and all opposition, but with actually working class people in direct control of their lives, of their industries, of their communities. So, I think that not only if Limerick had succeeded, not only would we have avoided that horror, but I think Russia could have dodged a bullet as well.